following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palacio, your host on this half an hour journey through culinary history. And today we're talking about something that is on everyone's plate, at least I would imagine once a week, and that is the potato. And my guest is Andy Smith. Andrew Smith is a teacher, a historian, a lecturer, a prolific writer. A few things I will mention, books that he has written. Andy, you are the master of the single subject, I have to say, too.
It's Somebody's got to do it. It's a tough job.
Some of the books have been Tomato, Turkey, Peanut, The Encyclopedia of Junk Food. Love that one. And Andy's also the editor of the Oxford Encyclopedia of American Food. And his most recent book, aside from Potato, which we're talking about today, is Starving the South, How the North Won the Civil War. But today, we're talking about the global history of the potato. And, you know, potato is something that everyone takes for granted. To be a good homemaker, one must put meat, vegetable, and potato on the dish, and then you have a complete meal, right?
My mother would start cooking the potatoes first before she figured out what the rest of the meal would be. So either go into the oven or they would go start boiling them. But that was the first
thing. But you got to have the potato on the plate.
That was the primary dish.
And okay, once a week you can have rice.
The meat was there and a few other things were there to dress it up.
Yeah, but the potato certainly has its place at the table. But where and when can we trace this tuber that we love so much?
Well, it's a really strange natural history. There's 235 different species of potatoes, and they really extend from Chile and South America all the way to the American Southwest. But of those, only seven were domesticated, and domestication starts about 12,000, 10,000 years ago in South America. Mm-hmm. And they domesticated seven of the varieties, and they became the place particularly in the high mountains of the Andes where nothing else would grow, this becomes the basis of what people ate. So it was extremely nutritious from a nutritional standpoint, the way they prepared it, and it worked out just fine.
Well, when you say domesticated, are there any wild potatoes today? And what's the difference between wild and domesticated potatoes?
There are large numbers of wild species of potatoes. There are large numbers of wild species of potatoes, and they're still around. They're still exactly in place where they are. If you go in the outside of South America, there's only essentially one variety of potato that's grown commercially.
Would we recognize a wild potato? I mean, what does it look like?
No, because they're all different colors, they're different shapes, they're different sizes, and they really have very different flavors and different tastes. So you have a huge diversity in South America. So if you go there and go to a market, there are 200 different varieties of potatoes that are on the market, and so you have a wide shift and a wide change.
Well, I'm impressed even by our markets today. The green markets used to be you'd go to the market and you'd find a bag of potatoes.
That's it. Right? Yeah.
Maybe russet and maybe a different style, but and then Yukon Gold came and everyone thought that they were very gourmet.
That was it.
And now you go to the green markets today and it's truly a panoply of colors and shapes and sizes. It is beautiful, but not quite that many.
That's only one species and one variety of one species. So you got 4,000 commercial varieties of that one type of potato. So
when you talk
huge.
About species, where we're going with yams and sweet potatoes?
Yams and sweet potatoes have no botanical relationship with the potato at all. So they're totally different location, points of origin, totally different in terms of the plant structure. So potato's a tuber, and so you have large numbers of other potato-like plants that produce tubers, and tubers, you can eat them. So they're edible, and they're quite different than what we think of as the potato.
Mm. These were, this was in South America, in the Andes.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the diaspora. How did the potato make its way onto every plate?
Well, it's very strange because the potato really does not make it out of South America prior to the European conquest in the mid-16th century. So unlike many other South American plants, like chili peppers, for instance, or like tomatoes, or like tobacco, or like peanuts, you know, thousands of other plants made it out of that into the Caribbean and into North America. The potato never does. And it's only when the Europeans run into it in the mid-16th century that it's got a lot of really good qualities. Among them, it's really easy to transport. And
heavy, but easy to transport.
But the heaviness is filled with good vitamins. So it's also filled with starch, and starch is, of course, the basic diet for most of the people of the 16th century. So it was the perfect diet food that worked out very nicely.
And then...
So that was
the mid-16th century?
Spanish run into it. They export it into Spain and Italy, where it does grow. But obviously the potato is more... It prefers real cold climates, and mm-hmm. so it goes into Northern Europe with the Spanish troops that go into Northern Europe, and it's there, and it doubles the population of Northern Europe in about 100 years. So it's
had a lot of food to eat, right?
Well, it's very prolific. The plant's very prolific itself, and it's relatively easy to grow. And once you plant it in the ground, you don't really have to do much to it.
And not only that, you gave a nice talk. A couple weeks ago, about the potato, and about this book, and a fun thing that you mentioned was about cloned vegetables. Had anyone eaten a cloned vegetable?
Well, so many of our plants that we eat are cloned. Potatoes, you can grow potatoes from seed, but they will not produce the same tuber that you had. You have huge diversity if you plant the seed pod from it. Not most of the seed pods now have been bred out, but you can virtually all commercial production is done by seed potatoes, and that's mm-hmm. done by either a small potato or by a part of a potato. And you, as long as it has the eye in it,
it'll can produce a multitude of plants.
It can produce up to 400 pounds, I think, is the record for a single potato plant. But typically, it could be several pounds of potatoes, and that's an awful lot for most people. If you have an acre of land, you can have enough food that will survive, for the full year. So it that really makes a huge difference in terms of Europe.
That's right. Well, let's talk about nutrition. I mean, you say the population doubled. We all know that there is vitamin B.
Yes, B6, yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
What else is
got vitamin
in
C in there? You got iron, you got zinc, you got fiber, you got potassium. What else could you want in a plant?
But if we could inject protein in it, we'd be all
well, but you have to combine it with something else.
Right.
And many of the European farmers had cows, and so if you put milk and cheese and other dairy products together with potatoes, it worked out very well, and it worked out enough so that population really mushroomed because of the introduction of the potato.
Now, you say that the population's doubled. We all hear a lot about, when we think about potatoes and potato crops and Northern Europe, of course, the first thing that comes to mind is the immigration to America of so many Irish, and because of the potato blight, and Ireland was inhospitable, nothing to eat, the crops wouldn't grow. I think there are a lot of misconceptions on that potato famine, and maybe you can...
I start off with putting it into the context. It's a European potato famine. It is just not Ireland, and so it really hits Belgium and hits Holland and hits Scandinavia. And many of the Scandinavians who come to America will also come because of the potato blight that hits them. So you have not just immigrants of Irish, which usually gets the news, but a large number of other Europeans that come. And the best estimates are 200,000 to 300,000 people in Northern Europe died because of the potato famine. Not Irish. We're talking people in Belgium and Holland. So it really is a blight that goes from Belgium and Holland into France and goes in the opposite direction to Prussia and to Russia. So you have a large number of different countries that are affected by it. And then it ends up in England, and from England it travels at 50 miles a day with the with the wind. And it's just a fascinating how you one looks at the newspapers and see the blight hitting.
Yeah.
And in England, they had just as potentially catastrophic problems in Scotland, for instance, where a million Highlanders from Scotland have to leave, and many of them go to England, and many come to the United States. So you have this. Then it hits Ireland.
And could they grow no other crops? They were so dependent upon that one particular crop. That was the interesting thing to me is that was
in the Highlands. Yes, that's the only thing you could grow. But in other places, you had alternate crops. So in rest of Scotland, for instance, you had oats, and you could fall back on other crops. And in France, you had southern France, which could supply the northern provinces that had problems with potatoes, with large number of other alternative foods. So it doesn't become as serious in those places as it will in Ireland. In Ireland, of course, there's a history between the British and the Irish. The Irish are essentially pushed to the western counties, which are all hilly, and you can't grow anything else other than potatoes there. So it is this group of people, not the people in southern Ireland, which is a huge agricultural area, which grew wheat and grew a whole series of other products. So you have, in fact, potatoes aren't even the largest agricultural product of Ireland. They're only 20% of the total production, and wheat and dairy and other products are much, much more important in terms of Irish agriculture. So when the famine hits, when the blight hits, you have a problem. And the problem is you have Catholics on one end, and you have Protestant controlled plantation-like farms that are in the southern agricultural area. And most of the plantation owners themselves are not wealthy. They're in bankruptcy. Most of them live in England. And so they're not able to feed people. And the government first steps in during the first year and actually does a very good job. They hire people to work on roads. And they set up.
But you got to feed them.
You got to feed. Well, but the idea was it was never a problem of lack of food. There was always food in Ireland to feed people. That wasn't the issue. The issue was those people who did not have their potato crops mature because of the blight, they didn't have any money to buy the food.
They couldn't sell them.
And
right.
So the question is, how do you get money? And one of the answers is if you get people to work, then you got money, and then they can buy their own food. And that was the hope. In the first year, there's no evidence anybody died due to starvation, lots of other diseases, but not that. It's economic issues. Yeah. But then the second year and the third year and the fourth year, and in the end you had a million Irish who died and another million who took flight to North America, 83% of which whom ended up in the United States. So
we're talking, this is like the mid-19th century, 1845?
This is beginning in 1846 and ending in 1852. But even after that, the conditions in Ireland were not particularly good. So that in 1840 you had 8 million people living in Ireland. In 1900 you have 4 million people living in Ireland. So you have large numbers of Irish who die because of the famine, large number of Irish who leave during the famine, and a large number of Irish who leave after the famine simply because there are no opportunities there.
Right.
So it's a huge influence on American history and on European history.
Yeah. Amazing that, I mean, or did the potato blight ever make it across the ocean?
Well, the first evidence for the potato blight is in 1842. It's in Philadelphia, and it's in New York. And so it really hits here earlier than it does in Europe. And most likely a ship from the United States brought the fungus to, northern Europe. And that's how it starts. But it didn't originate here. Originated in South America, so there was some interconnection that came from Chile to the United States. But the United States, nobody was dependent on the potato. You could easily just shift crops. You can't do that in West Ireland, where when the only thing that you really can grow is potatoes.
Peanuts. What about peanuts? No, they have to be. Has to be a lot warmer, right?
They're not the right geographical conditions. Yes.
All right. Well, you know, we're going to take a short break. There's so much more we have to talk about with potatoes, and also some wonderful things to talk about what happened with the potato. So after we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Andy Smith.
Thank you.
Public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to The Main Course Sundays at 12 p.m. with hosts Patrick Martins and Katie Kiefer. They examine issues from the interconnected worlds of agriculture, cuisine, and sustainability. They sit down with key players in the chain from producer to consumer, farmers, distributors, chefs, activists, and journalists. The Main Course explores every important component of the eating experience, how the farmers raise their product, the distribution channels that move the product, how the chefs prepare it, and how ethics and policy affect everyone involved. Again, that's The Main Course, Sundays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
We are back with my guest, Andy Smith, the author of Potato, A Global History, amongst many others. And speaking of Patrick Martin's, Katie Kiefer's Main Course, you heard an announcement about that during the break. Andy is going to be a guest on their show next month, and he will be talking about politics, about policy and ethics, policy and politics, starving the South, how the North won the Civil War. But today we're talking about potatoes.
And I love potatoes.
Mm-hmm. Any way you can dish them up, I'll eat them.
Do you have some potatoes here? I've been looking for them. Where are they?
That secret stash of potato chips in my bag. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Anyone who has kept potatoes around for a while or in the wrong place or has opened the cabinet saying, ooh, is there a dead mouse here or what, knows that storing potatoes can be a real trick sometimes. And, ooh, you don't want to step into the bag where there's that one rotten potato. Interesting, because same thing with a rotten apple. I mean, you know, it's one rotten potato can spoil the barrel. And so storing potatoes is an issue. If they're stored properly, they can keep for a long time, which makes them
months.
So valuable.
Just a couple right? months, a couple and that's months, about it, right. Yeah.
But you mentioned, you wrote a piece in your book about some prehistoric evidence of the people of the Andes and how they had an ingenious method for drying and preserving potatoes.
Yeah, the problem is if you try to store them, they're really only good for a couple of months, depending on the conditions under
right.
which you have it.
You start to get soft and mushy.
So you need to save some seed potatoes, which the soft and mushy doesn't matter. You can
right.
plant them and that'll work out just fine. But if you want to eat them, and particularly if you want to eat them months later, like 6 months, 9 months later, and if you want to prevent against a potential famine that comes along, you want to preserve it even longer than that, you need to figure out a new way to preserve them. And it is the indigenous peoples of the Andes that figured out what you have to do is you have to get rid of the water in the potato. And so they did this by putting them on mats and then stepping on them. letting them, well, of course, their feet were cleaned. You understand that. They follow proper hygiene. And then let them freeze during the night. And then during the next day when the sun comes out, then you walked on them again. Mm-hmm. And you kept doing this for several days. And you ended up with a very relatively thin piece of potato that you could store for months or years. And so they had huge storage places throughout the Andes that would prevent against a famine in case the potato crop, something happened to it. So this worked out very well. It's called chuño, and it's still
chuño.
And it's still made today.
They still do. They still preserve
absolutely,
them that way.
They don't walk on them anymore, but they preserve them in that way.
Yeah.
And it's
freeze-dried.
It's like freeze-dried
yeah.
potatoes. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Astronaut food. I mean, I suppose, you know, it's reconstituted. And is there evidence of, you know, the old, any of, they find any of the old, very old dried potatoes around?
Oh, yeah. They survived 500 years. Yes.
Wow.
Oh, absolutely. They're available if you would like to try them.
I think I'll pass.
I think I'll pass myself. But
right.
but the answer is yes, they certainly have survived. And again, it's the same process that they follow today in order to make the same thing. So it's not anything that just died out. It's a process that's continued.
Oh, necessity, the mother of invention, right? I mean, they
people like
to
it. It's not it's just not something to preserve. It's also something that people enjoy. It's part of their culture.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, in terms of preserving or extending the life, or in America, of course, marketing this wonderful tuber, a lot of different methods, not stepping on them necessarily, have come about. And I think of freezing, of course, number one. Freezing came about very early, frozen potatoes, didn't it?
Well, you really have a commercial frozen potato right after World War II. So it doesn't really become viable until the 1950s.
Who had freezers? Who could put them in a freezer?
You had nobody with freezer, right. part of the problem. But the other part, you had no commercial demand for them. And why, if you had access to potatoes throughout the year through a supermarket, well, why would you want a frozen potato? Right. And so there were lots of reasons on why it didn't take off until fast food came along. And fast food comes along, and initially the McDonald brothers did peel their potatoes in the back of their restaurant, and they did slice them, and they did handle them in terms of distribution. But when you expand to 1,000 different outlets, or right now 33,000 different outlets, right, you can't operate that way. So what they now
Oh, yes, I forgot to mention, you also wrote that book on hamburger. Of course,
I was hoping you'd mention that. Yes. No.
Forgot that.
But in this case, virtually all of the fast food potatoes that you consume, the French fries you consume, they're frozen. And they're frozen and cooked. They're cooked slightly, then frozen, and then they're recooked again when they come out. And that's the most efficient, from a commercial standpoint, the most efficient way to do it. I personally like the potato peeled and frozen, mm-hmm. Not frozen.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, if you have a chain restaurant outside of an individually owned restaurant that has the staff that can do them on demand, yeah, I guess you're right. Most all the French fries we eat are frozen.
Almost all of them are. Now, there are some chains that cook them fresh, like In-N-Out Burger in California, mm-hmm. and Five Guys Restaurant in Eastern. So you do have some restaurants that really pride themselves on frying normal potato rather than use a frozen potato.
And the French fries are good. No matter how you cook them up, they're good. But don't they lose a little something?
They lose a little something, but also they're really good conveyors for other flavors that were like ketchup, for instance, and salt, for instance, minor things like that.
Yeah. But the thing is people, potato gets maligned for, you know, being a fat food, a food that's going to make you fat. And of course, along come French fries, and then it's all the grease or the beef suet or the whatever the fat it's cooked in.
Potatoes have no fat whatsoever,
right.
So it's what we
everything
do to
we
them
add to them
on, which makes them a nutritional
the greasy gravy and
they're a nutritional catastrophe is the honest answer.
Yeah, but as you say, the vehicle for all those other flavors.
A few French fries now and then not going to hurt
kill you.
Anybody,
right.
You know. So.
And then along came the man from Saratoga.
Well, it's attributed to him, but actually I found recipes and cookbooks that had very thin potatoes that were,
I would imagine,
that were fried up.
France and Belgium.
Prior to that. Well, it could well be, but in the end it's the American from Saratoga, New York, that gets credit for creating potato chips. Saratoga chips, as they were called, promoting the hotel in which he was a chef. For early times, that's exactly what they had. And they really were not a major commercial success until the 1930s. And the main reason is you had to have a packaging revolution. You can't, they initially made potato chips, put them into barrels.
Talk about labor intensive.
And then there would be a sign on the barrel saying, you really probably should heat these before you consume them. And so that was not a success. And it's only when you have the cellophane-like bags that are produced that you can put names on the outside and you can brand them that you
and
really
that,
have success.
So when did that come about?
Really 1930s.
In the 30s as well?
Yeah, and that's when you have the beginning of Lay's potato chips and a number of other potato chips that we consume today had their origin in the 30s or 40s.
Well, there was the huge craze that took hold too, the whole salty snack craze took. Yeah.
Well, salty snacks have a history going back to popcorn and peanuts and things like that. Mm-hmm. But really, the chip world starts really has its big bang after World War II when supermarkets start marketing hundreds of different types of potato chips and corn chips and all the other types.
And
of
now
chips.
We're really talking fat. I mean, we're talking zero nutritional benefit here, right? I mean, zero
You would have to bring that up. Yes, I'm, yeah. I'm sorry to say there's no nutritional benefit in potato chips, but it's that psychological joy of just consuming one or two. You know,
that's no, you can't eat just one.
I can't.
They are good, but of they course, as a little side snack to that
I can't buy them anymore because I go through the bag from the beginning to the end. So I've
with
learned.
With the healthy sandwich or the healthy salad, you can eat a couple of chips, right? Well, aside from, frozen, we kind of did short shrift to the frozen potatoes. I mean, Orida, the big frozen company, did they become the largest frozen potato company?
They are
today still, Well, so many different companies have taken on different forms of frozen potatoes that people would never have thought to consume frozen and then reheated. Right. But every potato dish you can possibly imagine, I think, comes in a frozen form somewhere.
Right. And many frozen dinners, for instance, will have potatoes as a part of them.
Yeah. Oh, but they just the mashed potato never tasted as good in those TV dinners as, as mom's homemade.
I can remember the first TV dinner with the mashed potatoes down there. And even though it didn't taste good, it was the idea of having something that you could supposedly eat in front of a TV.
That's right.
And of course, TVs in the 50s were something, a shock and a surprise.
We can't talk about that. No one would quite understand.
The other real interesting use of potatoes, which you haven't mentioned, is in their liquid form, which ends up in vodka.
In vodka, that's right.
Well, not many vodkas today are made with potatoes. Most of them are grain-based. But you do have some specialty vodkas that do have a potato base. And, I can't tell.
Well, and a lot of people think that all Polish vodka is potato vodka, which is not true. It's not a rye, rye grain, other grain.
And neither is Russian vodka potato.
That's
vodka.
Right.
It's all grain-based.
Yeah. But there are plenty of potato vodkas on the market. I mean,
right.
you can taste there is a distinctive difference in the flavors. Interesting and good ones as well. As far as somebody who has tried to raise what you talked about, Parmentier trying to to raise the profile of the lowly potato, and that was an interesting story. Can you tell us a little bit?
Yeah, potatoes were in France before Parmentier, but he happened to be a soldier in the Seven Years' War, what we call the French and Indian War in America, and he was captured by the Prussians, and the Prussians put him in prison, and they served him potatoes, and that was the first time he had eaten potatoes. So when he got out of the prisoner of war camp after the war was over, he then said, "Well, I'm going to start experimenting with potatoes," and he does that, and he uses all sorts of techniques in order to get people to consume them, and one of those is in cooperation with Ben Franklin, who happens to be in Paris at the time during the American Revolution, to create this all potato dinner, of which I've tried to duplicate.
I did.
Yeah, my wife said, "Well, this is an awful lot of potatoes to consume in a single meal." But the goal was to introduce, in this case, the elite to potatoes, and it really didn't take off. He gets a lot of credit because he tried real hard and he published a lot of articles. But potatoes really don't take off in France until 50 years after his death, but the mid 19th century.
And there's a famous dish today that bears his name. The Parmentier.
The French, of course, once the potato entered into French cuisine, then it multiplies into dozens of different specialty dishes, which are still part of French cuisine today.
Yeah, interesting. We were talking about the potato. Okay, help me out here. We were talking about him and how it backfired. His dinner. Well. We'll come to another one. Now, you have a picture in your book of something that I'm not real sure about. It's the Jones Soda Company. Jones makes some really good sodas, if anyone knows the Jones Soda Company. But they have pictured in your book, and it called the mashed potato soda. Is this a real thing?
That's what they said. I believe everything.
Did you taste it?
I haven't tasted it, no. So I just want you to know that was unusual, and that's one of the early photographs right at the beginning of the book. And
And
it's supposed to say, what is this?
The response elicited from me.
Everybody knows what a potato is, and we have all these images of it. And my goal in the book was to say, hey, there are a lot of other things that are there that you don't think about.
Think outside the box.
And that's one of the reasons on why that picture ends up in there. But I haven't honestly tried it, so maybe if they're listening, they can send me a couple bottles that I can
I just can't begin to imagine what the flavor would be like, but I'm sure you add enough carbonation and sugar to it, anything could taste good, right? Is there a mashed potato jelly bean. We've got that.
I don't. There is the mashed potato dance, though.
And there is.
We're going to do it as soon as this program is over.
We will
do
the mashed potato out of here. That's right. Well, there. I mean, I think that potato is probably one of the most versatile.
Yes.
Vegetables that we can think of. As you said, a vehicle for lots of other flavors and sauces. But even on its own, you can fry it, boil it, mash it, chop it.
I don't know, eat it raw. I don't know of any other
vegetable
that can be served and prepared in so many different ways.
And as well as raw. People
don't eat raw potatoes in America. But
they're edible.
Yeah, they're edible. And the juice, by the way, which is most likely, if they do make the soda from the potato, is what they juice the potato and use it from that. But one of the things that really shocked me about the potato was how the potato has migrated from essentially North America, South America, and Europe into Asia. And India, I did know because I eat Indian food, and so therefore I was aware that potato plays a very important role, particularly in northern Indian food.
Right.
But the shock was, to me, China and People's Republic of China, which is now the largest producer of potatoes in the world. And I just never associated potatoes with Chinese cuisine.
Interesting.
And of course, as we have in the book, we have a couple recipes from China that are Chinese dishes. And,
I should have had those at the ready.
Yes, you are ready.
You
ready? Give them. Are we going to sample those a little later on?
I would love to do that.
Roberta's going to prepare them for us.
But I have to say, you know, spring is, I think, finally upon us. And all I can think about are picnics and outdoor food. And there again, you have potato salad. I mean, potatoes again.
My parents always called, my mother always called it German potato salad.
German potato salad.
And indeed,
that's the vinaigrette potato salad.
Yeah, there's
not
different,
the mayo.
They're different.
They're different
ways of making it. But indeed, I will look back and historically, there are German potato salads going back at least 300 years. So it was something that it wasn't just a made up name. It really was a heritage that came through.
That's right. And the German potato salad to me was always with the little bacon and the hot vinegar and wonderful.
It's a warm salad.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And now, of course, it's the season for new potatoes. So you've got and those are delicious.
Just pop them in the oven, roast them plain. Dip them in salt.
Mm. I'm hungry.
Well, Andy, once again, it's been an informative half an hour, and I hope that people have learned about the potato, and they can learn even more from your book, Potato, A
Thank
Global
you,
History. And this has been A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. In 2010, EscapeMaker.com won an Emmy Award for their agritourism webisode, so this year they thought, why not bring agritourism and green getaway ideas right to you? Come to the Green Getaway's Local Food and Travel Expo on April 30th at One Hanson Place, home of the Brooklyn Flea and former Williamsburg Savings Bank. Presented by Amtrak, Zipcar, and I Love New York, the carbon-free event will be a day filled with food, prizes, workshops, and kids' activities. Over 50 getaway destinations, from counties to local farms and bed and breakfasts within a day's drive or train ride of New York City, will be exhibiting on the main floor and in the huge bank vault downstairs. See what's hot in sustainable travel and receive special show-only discounts. Grow NYC will be doing workshops on the green market, and Appalachian Mountain Club will offer workshops on adventure bicycling and hiking via mass transit. EscapeMaker.com will be giving away over 50 getaway prizes, ranging from zipline adventure passes to an overnight stay at Mohonk Mountain House. Travel greener, eat local. Come to the expo on April 30th. Get your tickets now at www.escapemaker.com. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.
Whole Foods Market celebrates Earth Month with the Do Something Real Film Festival, a collection of six provocative, character-driven films focused on food, environmental issues, and everyday people with a greater vision. Come see one of the six features at City Cinemas Village East from Saturday, April 16th through Thursday, April 21st, every night at 6 p.m. Learn more about the films and special events at www.dosomethingreal.com. That's www.dosomethingreal.com. Sponsored by Whole Foods Market.